nicely. And on the other hand, if you stop and think about a random copolymer having two mole percent methine carbons, and the ethyl groups are not going into the crystal lattice, rather unexpected, to say the least, to see which will develop or not. If we go to the next copolymer, which I believe is 3.2%, you still see the lamellae. They're similar to what we saw at one of the higher molecular weights, but they're getting shorter and they're getting much curved, but again in the realm of lamellae. The next slide, the last one in this series, is for 4.5% methine carbons. And the electron microscopists sort of throw this away, it's not interesting, but it is. This sample is about 15% crystalline. And you can see little places. So the lamellae have become degraded, if you wish. That's the right word, or dissipated. But there are, you can still pick up the crystalline regions. So the point to be made here is one has in state command the ability to go from the kind of type of crystallized structure, from very long, flat, broad lamellae, to systems that aren't even lamella, and every stop in between. So this is the variable of the property that we have in control. The crystallized structure still staying within the framework of the lamellae. Now, one brief word, because I think it's going to come important with time, is the tilt angle that I mentioned, namely again the angle between the basal plane of the lamellae and the chain axis of the chain of the polymer of the chain. Now, by analyzing in more detail some of the electron micrographs, and also for other people have done by X-ray diffraction, one finds that for the polyethylene case, which unfortunately is the only case that's been studied in any detail, the chain axes are not normal to the broad face of the lamellae. At high crystallization temperatures or low undercoolings, the angle is close to zero, it's 19 degrees. But if you go to rapid crystallization temperatures, the angle is the order of 40 degrees. And we'll see in a few moments why this is an important fact. It's also must be important, I think it has a clue to us, which we haven't been able to fathom yet, as to something in terms of the details, the less phenomenological aspects of the crystallization mechanism. But we only know this for the polyethylene at the present time. Now, another variable that was important was the interface, or the interphase, or the interfacial structure. By consideration of properties and by the fluorine analysis and others of the small angle neutron scattering, one rules out the idea of having any type of regular folded interfacial structure. The question has really come through now is how much adjacent reentry is there in the bulk crystallized system which we're focusing in today. And the lamellar structure, as I mentioned, comes about from the space filling problem, the problem of dissipating the flux of change coming out of the broad phase of the lamellae. Now, in the interphase calculation of fluorine, Hume, and Dill that I mentioned early on, for polyethylene, they conclude that there's very little adjacent reentry, that is the order of about 15%. What you conclude in this type of calculation, or what you will conclude, will depend very crucially on the free energy for making a bend and on the tilt angle. For example, if you had a 45 degree tilt in polyethylene, depending on because of its crystal structure and because of its conformational properties, you have no problem at all with dissipating the flux that comes out of the basal plane. You can envisage some other type of chain where the bending energies are so favorable, which maybe Gauss is highly favored, that you might change that number. But so the calculations are only going to be physically meaningful when you can put rational number, reasonable numbers in for the tilt angle and for the bending energy, bending free energy. Now, there have already been several calculations which display perhaps the mathematical prowess of the authors, but neglect the tilt angle, more particularly the bending free energy. And the point is, if you stop to think about the problem and how to anticipate the flux, if it isn't going to cost you anything to make a fold, that's what you're going to do in great confusion to solve your problem. And if you go straight up, then you have a more serious problem than you have if you have a tilt. So it's not surprising that if you neglect the bending energy, you're going to come up with anywhere from 50 to 75% of adjacent reentry. That's, I think, you could argue this out without having to do too much mathematics, because it doesn't cost you anything to do that. So the real problem is to analyze for cases besides polyethylene the balance between having to dissipate the flux and the energy it costs you to figure out how you're going to do it, or to calculate how you're going to do it. Now, the other part of the interfacial problem is the how thick is the interface, and what is the relative amount? Now, there are various ways of trying to get at the relative thickness or the relative amount of the interface. If you know the thickness of your crystallite, then you can calculate the thickness of the interface. The method that we've been using is a rough analysis of the Raman internal loading method. You get pretty much similar results if you use broadline proton NMR, as has been done by Kitamura some years ago. And several other methods will show you that there is a significant interface. Recent carbon 13 analysis shows a resonance that can reasonably be attributed to the interface, and careful analysis of small angle scattering indicates that two-phase analysis does not work, and you have to bring in some 10, 15 angstrom thick interface. But to be quantitative, we found this Raman method rather useful, at least consistent. It may not be, the numbers may not be precise, but things scale, and that's the right in a way that's very informative. And if I can have the next slide, the table for the linear polyethylenes, and alpha B is our notation for the fraction of the material that's in the interface as opposed to which is in the crystal or which is in the liquid like. And for low molecular weights in the order of less than 300,000, it's either 0 to 5%. The experiment error is relatively large. When you go to higher molecular weights, then you're in the order of 10%, and the mode of crystallization doesn't seem to be important. I would like, when we get to talking about properties, if you have been putting a lot of numbers to you, if you try to remember this column here, that at low molecular weights, that is 200,000 less, not so low, you don't get much of an interfacial contribution. When you start getting the high molecular weights, you do. And the next slide carries the same kind of argument over to copolymers. These are random type ethylene copolymers. And we code them hydrogenated polybutadiene, ethylene butene, ethylene octene, ethylene bioacetate. These are all fractions of branched polyethylenes and ethylene propylene. And I say the diazo and propyl, because this was actually work that was done by Richardson. The polymers were made by Richardson Jackson back in 1963. And Professor Fleury gave me some about 1970, and Rachel Sabin, they stayed nice and stable. And when we wanted to look at some systems, these are very high molecular weight, so they have a higher value of alpha B, because these are the multi-millions, than the more conventional ones. They're scattered. But as we increase the mole percent branches for the co-unit, then we go from our 5% that we had for a linear polymer all the way up to the order of 20% interfacial content for the random type copolymers, which again I would like you to remember because I think it would play important, but try and demonstrate that this plays an important part contribution to certain properties. Now the next to last, third from last, property that's important, structure that's important, is the crystallite thickness. And here we have to be concerned about several things: how we crystallize, the molecular weight, and how long we crystallize. And I'm going to take two extremes. I'm going to crystallize very rapidly and look at the crystallite thickness distribution by Raman, LAM. If I could have the next slide, please, Wayne. Here we have, this is the rapid crystallization. And we have these are quenching temperatures, not crystallization temperatures, but they're reproducible for films of the same thickness. We run from 10 to the 6th to 10 to the 4th. So for any, and these are half widths, these are widths rather, of the distribution at half heights. For crystallized size distributions of polymers, these are fairly narrow distributions. And there is no molecular weight effect. If you crystallize rapidly, there is a slight effect of the quenching temperature. and you can therefore prepare and narrow distributed samples in the order between 200 and 100 angstroms. Now, if you want thicker crystals, then you certainly can make thicker crystals by atmospheric crystallization up to several thousand angstroms. You have to do this isothermally at high temperature crystallization. And then you have to, turns out, you have to pay a price. The price is a very broad molecular weight distribution, because as the system is crystallizing over the long times that are involved, you get a thickening effect, which is well documented now. And so one can have, and we'll see examples of large thicknesses, in some cases up to several thousand angstroms, but these are always in systems with very broad size distributions, because they have to be done isothermally. Now, if we get away from the loop, from the linear polymers, we go to the branched copolymers, they can range in thickness from 40 angstroms to 100 angstroms, depending primarily on how we crystallize. Now, the important part of the structure that we can't say very much about is the residual liquid-like structure, which would be the isotropic structure between the lamella, that is, be the structure between the lamella that's not in the interface. And this can comprise, as we've seen from our level of crystallinity, a significant portion of our system. If I can have the next slide, please. Okay, this is an artist's rendition. It takes a few moments to get used to what might be happening. And what we have is one lamella crystalline and a chain, some of them coming back in, and that's not a concern for this particular slide. We're concerned with those that are coming out and going to the next crystallite, and those that are coming. This region between here and here is essentially isotropic, theoretically, and unfortunately so far, experimentally. But one can envisage, with a little imagination, a large number of different ways that the chains can be isotropic. We can have a loop that comes back and does nothing. We can have a loop that's coming back here and hooking on with another one here, essentially connecting two lamellae. We can have chains that are just going across. We can have chains that are not interlocking or knotting and going from here. The problem is that these will probably be contributing to certain properties in different ways. And experimentally so far, because all these kinds of structures that we've been able to think of are isotropic, it's difficult to devise an experiment to distinguish one experiment to the other, and so we are, fortunately or unfortunately at the moment, in the hands of the theorists to give us some guidance as to what might be reasonable kinds of structures to expect, because there are reasons to believe that for the same levels of crystallinity, certain properties, particular mechanical ones, can be quite different, and we think it's probably involved in what's between these lamella. So this is a problem for the future, and one that we don't have much to contribute except a great concern for. The last of the independent structural variables is probably the one that's been extraordinarily popular with people, namely the supramolecular structure. That is, how are the crystallites organized in space, and what effects then, as we'll see, do they have or don't have on properties? Now, there are various ways of studying supramolecular structure. The one we chose as the sort of semi-routine one is small angle light scattering using the HB mode, a technique that was pioneered by Stein and by Fawai. And if you take polyethylene and or polyethylene oxide, which are the two polymers we studied intensively, if I could have the next slide, shows that in the small angle light scattering patterns, you can see five different types of patterns. You see the one on the upper left, marked A, is a standard cloverleaf with no intensity in the center. That's the classical cerulite pattern. And you can have cloverleafs with sort of degraded things. We'll talk about what they mean in a moment. This one has azimuthal scattering. You look carefully. And this is a two-dimensional and circularly symmetric. Theoretically, Stein and Kawhi and others can have related these patterns to morphological or supramolecular structures, which I've summarized on the next slide in a notation system which isn't so good, but I'll have to ask you to remember for a few moments. On the left here, we have the five patterns that we've actually observed. And these are the type of supermolecular structures, A, B, and C. I've just serialized, which are less well-ordered or degrading, as you have A, B, C. D are thin rods or rod-like aggregates. G is a rod comparable, the breadth comparable to length, which essentially makes them sheet-like. And H is randomly oriented lamellae. These two, should be a bracket here, come from the same H angular dependence. That's why we have a bad notation. So that if you see no scattering, then you don't know what you have unless you go ahead and do some electron microscopy. We'll be talking about these and all, if there's ever a question, we settle it by electron microscopy. And I might say before, those who aren't happy with, there are people sometimes who aren't happy with small angle light scattering. All the structures and situations where we see, where we have seen a particular structure, thin section, electron microscopy has confirmed that structure, so the small angle light scattering is a rather good technique. Now what you can do is now look at your molecular weight range that you have at your command, your crystallization conditions, and just see what type of supermolecular structure you get under particular conditions. So let's remember the letters A, B, C, D, G, H from this column here, okay? And the next line, please, thank you, is what we call a morphological map. This is for the linear polyethylene. And this is the isothermal crystallization region. And you see various, you see interesting thing, which we did these first up there, at a very high molecular weight. You see no superstructure. And you see very poor spherulites. You see a lot of these sheet and rod-like structures. And the main thing is, depending on the molecular weight and the crystallization conditions, you can see a lot of different structures. As a matter of fact, even for fairly low molecular weights, a little bit over 100,000, rapidly crystallized, you don't see any superstructure. That's interesting. From a pragmatic, practical sense, you can pick a molecular weight, let's say here, and by changing the crystallization conditions for the same molecular weight, you can go through a whole myriad of supermolecular structures, and then you could ask yourself, by appropriate experiment, what effect does the supermolecular structure have on a given property? It also turns out, quite fortuitously, that in some of these situations, the level of crystallinity that you get doesn't change very much, so that sort of nasty variable is not present with you, and that was just fortuitous. So then we can utilize this. Now you can do the same sort of thing with branch polymers and copolymers, except of course you have another variable worrying about the extent of the branching, but that's been worked out. So these morphological maps allow us to address the question, and those who've been following the properties of polymers know that there's been a great focus all the time on spherulites, and of course you can see spherulites. The point I want to make, you don't always see spherulites. So now we can turn for the last 7 or 8 minutes, 10 minutes that I have, to the properties. Now, admittedly, I spent a disproportionate amount of my time talking about the structure. But this was you had to know something about the structure and something about how you could control the structure by varying molecular weight, change structure, and crystallization conditions to answer what does a particular property depend on, or what's controlling a particular property. Excuse me. Now, I'll just in passing say that it turns out that a large number of properties, if we can have the next slide, please, Wayne, depends on nothing more than the level of crystallinity. So tempered sometimes by a contribution from the interfacial free energy or the structure of the interface. There are probably several more that can be added on. Mostly now I'd like to address this kind of the data, this approach and strategy we have, to the problem of mechanical properties and to two types of mechanical properties. One is the low-frequency dynamic mechanical properties, and the other is the large deformation force light measurements. In the dynamic mechanical measurements, in most crystalline polymers, and particularly polyethylene, there are a series of transitions energy loss peaks, which have been given names, and the molecular basis what's causing that in some cases have been some confusion and some controversy. In the polyethylene, we have the alpha, beta, not talking about the melting transition, the alpha, beta, and the gamma transition. We are presently working on the gamma transition, so I will pass the discussion on that. The alpha transition, these are low frequency, we have Vibron experiments, has been pretty well thought about, involved motions within the crystalline region, and it was sort of guessed at it, dependent on the thickness of the crystallites, plus some other things. But now you can, if I can have the next slide, let me go through these quickly. If we look at the temperature of the alpha transition, this is the linear polyethylene, and varying our superstructure, and plotting the data against the crystallite thickness, one finds quite quickly that the temperature of the alpha transition depends only on the crystallite thickness, and the important point in this set of experiments is that the supermolecular structure has nothing, does contributes nothing. And I might say, as I might forget before I end, the important point is that the superstructure does not really determine any property that we've studied, except obviously it'll determine optical properties of having structures that can scatter light. But none of the mechanical properties that we've studied does the superstructure show any effects on at all. The next slide, or the next section that I'd like to talk about, if we hold the slide, is the beta transition in the polyethylenes, which occurs between the gamma and the alpha. And there's been somewhat of a controversy for a long time. It's somewhat of an enigma. It's very intense transition in the branch polyethylenes, that's accepted, the copolymers. And there's always been an argument, discussion as to whether it exists in the linear polyethylenes. There have been grouped papers by very respected investigators have said, yes, there is a transition on the linear polyethylene, and then a group that said, no, there isn't, and all very nice and respectable data. It's also been argued that the beta transition, and primarily the branch and sometimes the linear, is the glass temperature. That can be ruled out by proton decoupled NMR, because you can measure relaxation times right through, get spectra rather, right through the beta transition. If you make the postulate, and we didn't just pull this out of the air, this was a consequence of what we could see, and we found, for example, that if you worked with high molecular weight polyethylenes, you didn't need to see the beta transition in the dynamic mechanical experiment, while in the low molecular weight polyethylenes, you didn't, and that explained at least the experimental discrepancy without much problem, and also pointed out that perhaps what is contributing to the beta transition is the interfacial contact. And if you make that assumption and start to make this, then you make this table, and this table then tells you when you do, or the situations one has seen and not seen the beta transition, and how it relates to the measured interfacial contents, and then I think we conclude that we have an interfacial content on our scale of the order of 10% or greater. One sees a beta transition, and if it's less than 10%, one doesn't see the beta transition. And with this assumption or supposition, one is able to unify something that's been causing people working in this field lots of concern for a long time. It's been this argument of the importance of mechanical properties of the beta transition. That's also recently, last week, used by Yoon and Wendorf and applied to explaining some puzzling factors in the dielectric relaxation of polyvinylidene chloride. It explains the transition that shows up in copolymers of polyoxymethylene with polyoxyethylene. It shows up in randomly chlorinated polyethylene as against a block chlorinated polyethylene. And presumably, if one works hard enough, one would be able to see this in all crystalline polymers and certainly in all crystalline copolymers. Now, if I have 5 more minutes, do I have 5 or 6 more minutes? Okay. I would like to proceed to something new or different, and something different for us, namely looking at the large deformation mechanical properties, force length relations, and particularly ultimate properties. Now, this is obviously a complex kind of property that's been widely studied for a long time, and what we like to do is apply our strategy of trying to isolate the variables to this. And what I would like to focus on, don't have time, you can apply the strategy, and there will be a paper appearing in the next few months in the Journal of Polymer Science, applying the strategy to all the aspects of the force length curve that we'll see in a moment. All I'll have time for this afternoon is to look at the general character and on the ultimate properties. And if I can have the next slide, please. If you look at almost any review article in any textbook, just a new textbook, I think the year for undergraduates just appeared, and this appears, this is a typical stress strain curve for a semi-crystalline polymer. You have your yield, you have this neck region or inhomogeneous deformation, this is called strain hardening, and this is a typical quote-unquote force length curve, and then it's explained, or described rather than explained, next slide, by how you deform the strain length. And this, I think, is the standard almost in any book or any review article on mechanical properties, any book on physics or physical properties of polymers. The next slide shows you how it's been explained. You start off with these regular folded, well, it's assumed that the deformation of the semi-crystalline polymer is identical to the plasticity of the crystals of low lightweight substances. That's the underlying assumption that's been through this field for a long time. And then you start now, it's very simple, you start with a regular folded lamellae, you go through slippage and twinning, mark and tight transformations, and eventually unfolding the chain, and then you get cracked. Well, from what I've been saying the last 15 to 20 minutes, I don't think you'd be surprised that I would be bothered by these last two slides. And these are taken from standard sort of things. One is, we don't always see